8. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22:6. There were other floggings, but darn few. Hendrick was the only man in our regiment to be flogged by sentence of court-martial. The others were administrative punishment, like mine. And for lashes, it was necessary to go all the way up to the regimental commander, which a subordinate commander finds distasteful. To put it faintly. Even then, Major Malloy was much more likely to kick the man out, undesirable discharge, than to have the whipping post erected. In a way, an administrative flogging is the mildest sort of a compliment. It means that your supervisors think that there is a faint possibility that you just might have the character eventually to make a soldier and a citizen, unlikely as it seems at the moment. I was the only one to get the maximum administrative punishment. None of the others got more than 3 lashes. Nobody else came as close as I did to putting on civilian clothes, but I still squeaked by. This is a social distinction of sorts. I don't recommend it. But we had another case, much worse than mine or Ted Hendricks. A really sick-making one. Once, they erected gallows. Now look, get this straight. This case didn't really have anything to do with the Army. The crime didn't take place at Camp Curie, and the placement officer who accepted this boy for MI should turn in his suit. He deserted only 2 days after we arrived at Curie. Ridiculous, of course, but nothing about the case made sense. Why didn't he resign? Desertion, naturally, is one of the 31 crash landings. But the Army doesn't invoke the death penalty for it unless there are special circumstances, such as in the face of the enemy, or something else that turns it from a highly informal way of resigning into something that can't be ignored. The Army makes no effort to find deserters and bring them back. This makes the hardest kind of sense. We're all volunteers. We're MI because we want to be. We're proud to be MI, and MI is proud of us. If a man doesn't feel that way about it, from his calloused feet to his hairy ears, I don't want him on my flank when trouble starts. If I buy a piece of it, I want the men around me who will pick me up because they're MI, and I'm MI. And my skin means as much to them as their own. I don't want any ersatz soldiers dragging their tails and ducking out when the party gets rough. It's a whole lot safer to have a blank file on your flank than to have an alleged soldier who is nursing the conscript syndrome. So if they run, let them run. It's a waste of time and money to fetch them back. Of course, most of them do come back, though it may take them years, in which case the Army tiredly lets them have their 50 lashes instead of hanging them and turns them loose. I suppose it must wear on a man's nerves to be a fugitive, when everybody else is either a citizen or a legal resident, even when the police aren't trying to find him. The wicked flee when no man pursueth. The temptation to turn yourself in, take your lumps, and breathe easily again must get to be overpowering. But this boy didn't turn himself in. He was gone 4 months, and I doubt if his own company remembered him, since he had been with them only a couple of days. He was probably just a name without a face, the Dillinger, N.L., who had to be reported, day after day, as absent without leave on the morning muster. Then he killed a baby girl. He was tried and convicted by a local tribunal, but identity check showed that he was an undischarged soldier. The department had to be notified, and our commanding general at once intervened. He was returned to us, since military law and jurisdiction take precedence over civil code. Why did the general bother? Why didn't he let the local sheriff do the job? In order to teach us a lesson? Not at all. I'm quite sure that our general did not think that any of his boys needed to be nauseated in order not to kill any baby girls. By now, I believe that he would have spared us that sight, had it been possible. We did learn a lesson, though nobody mentioned it at the time, and it is one that takes a long time to sink in until it becomes second nature. The MI take care of their own, no matter what. Dillinger belonged to us. He was still on our rolls. Even though we didn't want him, even though we should never have had him, even though we should have been happy to disclaim him, he was a member of our regiment. We couldn't brush him off and let a sheriff 1,000 miles away handle it. If it has to be done, a man, a real man, shoots his own dog himself. He doesn't hire a proxy who may bungle it. The regimental records said that Dillinger was ours, so taking care of him was our duty. That evening we marched to the parade grounds at slow march, 60 beats to the minute. Hard to keep step when you're used to 140, while the band played dirge for the unmourned. Then Dillinger was marched out, dressed in MI full dress just as we were, and the band played Danny Deaver, while they stripped off every trace of insignia, even buttons and cap, leaving him in a maroon and light blue suit that was no longer a uniform. The drums held a sustained roll, and it was all over. We passed in review, and on home at the fast trot. I didn't think anybody fainted, and I don't think anybody quite got sick, even though most of us didn't eat much dinner that night, and I've never heard the mess tent so quiet. But grisly as it was the first time I had seen death, first time for most of us. It was not the shock that Ted Hendricks' flogging was. I mean, you couldn't put yourself in Dillinger's place. You didn't have any feeling of, it could have been me. Not counting the technical matter of desertion, Dillinger had committed at least 4 capital crimes. If his victim had lived, he still would have danced Danny Deaver for any one of the other 3. Kidnapping, demand of ransom, criminal neglect, etc. I had no sympathy for him and still haven't. That old saw that to understand all is to forgive all is a lot of tripe. Some things, the more you understand, the more you loathe them. My sympathy is reserved for Barbara Ann Enthwaite, whom I had never seen, and for her parents, who would never again see their little girl. As the band put away their instruments that night, we started 30 days of mourning for Barbara, and of disgrace for us. With our colors draped in black, no music at parade, no singing on route march. Only once did I hear anybody complain, and another boot promptly asked him how he would like a full set of lumps. Certainly it hadn't been our fault, but our business was to guard little girls, not kill them. Our regiment had been dishonored. We had to clean it. We were disgraced, and we felt disgraced. That night I tried to figure out how such things could be kept from happening. Of course, they hardly ever do nowadays, but even once is way too many. I never did reach any answer that satisfied me. This Dillinger, he looked like anybody else, and his behavior and record couldn't have been too odd, or he would never have reached Camp Curie in the first place. I suppose he was one of those pathological personalities you read about. No way to spot them. Well, if there was no way to keep it from happening once, there was only one sure way to keep it from happening twice, which we had used. If Dillinger had understood what he was doing, which seems credible, then he got what was coming to him, except that it seemed a shame that he hadn't suffered as much as had little Barbara Ann. He practically hadn't suffered at all. But suppose, as seemed more likely, he was so crazy that he had never been aware that he was doing anything wrong. What then? Well, we shoot mad dogs, don't we? Yes, but being crazy that way is a sickness. I couldn't see but 2 possibilities. Either he couldn't be made well, in which case he was better off dead for his own sake and for the safety of others, or he could be treated and made sane, in which case, it seemed to me, if he ever became sane enough for civilized society, and thought over what he had done while he was sick. What could be left for him but suicide? How could he live with himself? And suppose he escaped before he was cured and did the same thing again, and maybe again. How do you explain that to bereaved parents, in view of his record? I couldn't see but one answer. I found myself mulling over a discussion in our class in history and moral philosophy. Mr. Dubois was talking about the disorders that preceded the breakup of the North American Republic back in the 20th century. According to him, there was a time just before they went down the drain when such crimes as Dillinger's were as common as dogfights. The terror had not been just in North America. Russia and the British Isles had it too, as well as other places. But it reached its peak in North America shortly before things went to pieces. Law-abiding people, Dubois told us, hardly dared go into a public park at night. To do so was to risk attack by wolf packs of children, armed with chains, knives, homemade guns, bludgeons. To be hurt at least, robbed most certainly, injured for life probably, or even killed. This went on for years, right up to the war between the Russo-Anglo-American alliance and the Chinese hegemony. Murder, drug addiction, larceny, assault, and vandalism were commonplace. Nor were parks the only places. These things happened also on the streets in daylight, on school grounds, even inside school buildings. But parks were so notoriously unsafe that honest people stayed clear of them after dark. I had tried to imagine such things happening in our schools. I simply couldn't. Nor in our parks. A park was a place for fun, not for getting hurt. As for getting killed in one, Mr. Dubois, didn't they have police or courts? They had many more police than we have, and more courts, all overworked. I guess I don't get it. If a boy in our city had done anything half that bad, well, he and his father would have been flogged side by side. But such things just didn't happen. Mr. Dubois then demanded of me, define a juvenile delinquent. One of those kids, the ones who used to beat up people.
Wrong.
Huh? But the book said... My apologies. Your textbook does so state. But calling a tail a leg does not make the name fit. Juvenile delinquent is a contradiction in terms. One which gives a clue to their problem and their failure to solve it. Have you ever raised a puppy?
Yes, sir.
Did you housebreak him?
Yes, sir. Eventually.
It was my slowness in this that caused my mother to rule that dogs must stay out of the house.
Ah, yes. When your puppy made mistakes, were you angry?
What?
Why, he didn't know any better. He was just a puppy.
What did you do?
Why, I scolded him and rubbed his nose in it and paddled him.
Surely he could not understand your words.
No, but he could tell I was sore at him.
But you just said that you were not angry.
Mr. Dubois had an infuriating way of getting a person mixed up. No, but I had to make him think I was. He had to learn, didn't he?
Conceded.
But, having made it clear to him that you disapproved, how could you be so cruel as to spank him as well? You said the poor beastie didn't know that he was doing wrong, yet you inflicted pain. Justify yourself. Or are you a sadist?
I didn't then know what a sadist was, but I knew pups.
Mr. Dubois, you have to. You scold him so that he knows he's in trouble. You rub his nose in it so that he will know what trouble you mean. You paddle him so that he darn well won't do it again. And you have to do it right away. It doesn't do a bit of good to punish him later. You'll just confuse him. Even so, he won't learn from one lesson, so you watch, and you catch him again and paddle him still harder. Pretty soon he learns, but it's a waste of breath just to scold him.
Then I added, I guess you've never raised pups.
Many. I'm raising a dachshund now, by your methods. Let's get back to those juvenile crimes. The most vicious averaged somewhat younger than you here in this class.
and they often started their lawless careers much younger. Let us never forget that puppy. These children were often caught. Police arrested batches each day. Were they scolded? Yes, often scathingly. Were their noses rubbed in it? Rarely. News organs and officials usually kept their names secret. In many places, the law so required for criminals under 18. Were they spanked? Indeed not. Many had never been spanked even as small children. There was a widespread belief that spanking, or any punishment involving pain, did a child permanent psychic damage. I had reflected that my father must have never heard of that theory. Corporal punishment in schools was forbidden by law, he had gone on. Flogging was lawful as sentence of court only in one small province, Delaware, and there only for a few crimes and was rarely invoked. It was regarded as cruel and unusual punishment. Dubois had mused aloud. I don't understand objections to cruel and unusual punishment. While a judge should be benevolent in purpose, his awards should cause the criminal to suffer, else there is no punishment. And pain is the basic mechanism built into us by millions of years of evolution, which safeguards us by warning when something threatens our survival. Why should society refuse to use such a highly perfected survival mechanism? However, that period was loaded with pre-scientific, pseudo-psychological nonsense. As for unusual, punishment must be unusual or it serves no purpose. And then he pointed his stump at another boy. What would happen if a puppy were spanked every hour? Probably drive him crazy. Probably. It certainly would not teach him anything. How long has it been since the principal of this school last had to switch a pupil? I'm not sure. About 2 years? The kid that swiped, never mind. Long enough. It means that such punishment is so unusual as to be significant, to deter, to instruct. Back to these young criminals. They probably were not spanked as babies. They certainly were not flogged for their crimes. The usual sequence was, for a first offense, a warning, a scolding, often without trial. After several offenses, a sentence of confinement, but with sentence suspended, and the youngster placed on probation. A boy might be arrested many times and convicted several times before he was punished, and then it would be merely confinement, with others like him, from whom he learned still more criminal habits. If he kept out of major trouble while confined, he could usually evade most of even that mild punishment, be given probation, paroled in the jargon of the times. This incredible sequence could go on for years while his crimes increased in frequency and viciousness, with no punishment whatever, save rare, dull but comfortable confinements. Then suddenly, usually by law on his 18th birthday, this so-called juvenile delinquent becomes an adult criminal, and sometimes wound up in only weeks or months in a death cell, awaiting execution for murder. You. He had singled me out again. Suppose you merely scolded your puppy, never punished him, let him go on making messes in the house, and occasionally locked him up in the outbuilding, but soon let him back in the house with a warning not to do it again. Then one day you notice that he is now a grown dog and still not housebroken, whereupon you whip out a gun and shoot him dead. Comment, please. Why, that's the craziest way to raise a dog I ever heard of. I agree. Or a child. Whose fault would it be? Why, mine, I guess. Again, I agree. But I'm not guessing. Mr. Dubois, a girl blurted out. But why? Why didn't they spank those little kids when they needed it, and use a good dose of the strap on the older ones who deserved it? The sort of lesson they wouldn't forget. I mean, ones who did things really bad. Why not? I don't know, he had answered grimly. except that the time-tested method of instilling social virtue and respect for law in the minds of the young did not appeal to the pre-scientific pseudo-professional class that called themselves social workers, or sometimes child psychologists. It was too simple for them, apparently, since anybody could do it, using only the patience and firmness needed in training a puppy. I have sometimes wondered if they cherished a vested interest in disorder, but that is unlikely. Adults almost always act from conscious, highest motives, no matter what their behavior. "But good heavens," the girl answered. "I don't like being spanked any more than any kid does. But when I needed it, my mama delivered. The only time I ever got a switching in school, I got another one when I got home, and that was years and years ago. I don't ever expect to be hauled up in front of a judge and sentenced to a flogging. You behave yourself and such things don't happen. I don't see anything wrong with our system. It's a lot better than not being able to walk outdoors for fear of your life. Well, that's horrible."
"I agree. Young lady, the tragic wrongness of what those well-meaning people did, contrasted with what they thought they were doing, goes very deep. They had no scientific theory of morals. They did have a theory of morals that they tried to live by. I should not have sneered at their motives. But their theory was wrong. Half of it, fuzzy-headed wishful thinking. Half of it, rationalized charlatanry. The more earnest they were, the farther it led them astray. You see, they assumed that man has a moral instinct."
"Sir, I thought, but he does. I have."
"No, my dear. You have a cultivated conscience, a most carefully trained one. Man has no moral instinct. He is not born with moral sense. You were not born with it. I was not born with it. And the puppy has none.
We acquire moral sense, when we do, through training, experience, and hard sweat of the mind. These unfortunate juvenile criminals were born with none, even as you and I, and they had no chance to acquire any. Their experiences did not permit it. What is moral sense? It is an elaboration of the instinct to survive. The instinct to survive is human nature itself, and every aspect of our personalities derives from it. Anything that conflicts with the survival instinct acts, sooner or later, to eliminate the individual and thereby fails to show up in future generations. This truth is mathematically demonstrable, everywhere verifiable. It is the single eternal imperative controlling everything we do. But the instinct to survive," he had gone on, "can be cultivated by motivations more subtle and much more complex than the blind, brute urge of the individual to stay alive. Young lady, what you miscall your moral instinct was the instilling in you by your elders of the truth that survival can have stronger imperatives than that of your own personal survival. Survival of your family, for example, of your children, when you have them, of your nation, if you struggle that high up the scale, and so on. A scientifically verifiable theory of morals must be rooted in the individual's instinct to survive, and nowhere else, and must correctly describe the hierarchy of survival, note the motivations at each level, and resolve all conflicts. We have such a theory now. We can solve any moral problem on any level. Self-interest, love of family, duty to country, responsibility toward the human race. We are even developing an exact ethic for extra-human relations. But all moral problems can be illustrated by one misquotation. Greater love hath no man than a mother cat dying to defend her kittens. Once you understand the problem facing that cat and how she solved it, you will then be ready to examine yourself and learn how high up the moral ladder you are capable of climbing. These juvenile criminals hit a low level. Born with only the instinct for survival, the highest morality they achieved was a shaky loyalty to a peer group, a street gang. But the do-gooders attempted to appeal to their better natures, to reach them,
to spark their moral sense. Tosh. They had no better natures. Experience taught them that what they were doing was the way to survive. The puppy never got his spanking. Therefore, what he did with pleasure and success must be moral. The basis of all morality is duty, a concept with the same relation to group that self-interest has to individual. Nobody preached duty to these kids in a way they could understand, that is, with a spanking. But the society they were in told them endlessly about their rights. The result should have been predictable, since a human being has no natural rights of any nature. Mr. Dubois paused. Somebody took the bait. Sir, how about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Yes. The unalienable rights. Each year someone quotes that magnificent poetry.
Life? What right to life has a man who is drowning in the Pacific? The ocean will not hearken to his cries. What right to life has a man who must die if he is to save his children? If he chooses to save his own life, does he do so as a matter of right? If two men are starving and cannibalism is the only alternative to death, which man's right is unalienable? And is it right? As liberty, the heroes who signed the great document pledged themselves to buy liberty with their lives. Liberty is never unalienable. It must be redeemed regularly with the blood of patriots, or it always vanishes. Of all the so-called natural human rights that have ever been invented, liberty is the least likely to be cheap and is never free of cost. The third right, the pursuit of happiness, it is indeed unalienable, but it is not a right. It is simply a universal condition which tyrants cannot take away, nor patriots restore. Cast me into a dungeon, burn me at the stake, crown me king of kings. I can pursue happiness as long as my brain lives, but neither gods nor saints, wise men nor subtle drugs, can ensure that I will catch it. Mr. Dubois then turned to me. I told you that juvenile delinquent is a contradiction in terms. Delinquent means failing in duty, but duty is an adult virtue. Indeed, a juvenile becomes an adult when, and only when, he acquires a knowledge of duty and embraces it as dearer than the self-love he was born with. There never was, there cannot be, a juvenile delinquent. But for every juvenile criminal, there are always one or more adult delinquents, people of mature years who either do not know their duty or who, knowing it, fail. And that was the soft spot which destroyed what was, in many ways, an admirable culture. The junior hoodlums who roamed their streets were symptoms of a greater sickness. These citizens, all of them counted as such, glorified their mythology of rights and lost track of their duties. No nation, so constituted, can endure. I wonder how Colonel Dubois would have classed Dillinger. Was he a juvenile criminal who merited pity, even though you had to get rid of him? Or was he an adult delinquent who deserved nothing but contempt? I didn't know. I would never know. The one thing I was sure of was that he would never again kill any little girls. That suited me. I went to sleep.